I would like to invite now Rihanna to give us an overview of IFRS 9, and I'm going to share the slides from my end.
Anna, will you also be controlling them?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
If you just give me a prompt.
Yeah, I'll let you know. Thank you. So just to maybe recap on, you know, the history of IFRS 9 and really what the standard aimed to achieve or what the board's objective was, if we maybe can move on to the next one. And I think, you know, let's just go to slide 4. It might be easier to start there. Yeah. So if you you might recall that IFRS 9 was initially, when the board developed the standard, it was done in discrete phases. So the board did classification and measurement, then we did impairment, and we did hedge accounting separately. And all of those phases were published at different times. But in 2014, the board published the completed version of IFRS 9 with an effective date of 1 January 2018. And the intention is definitely that IFRS 9 replaces IAS 39. And so apart from some hedge accounting pieces that are still in place, IFRS 9 has replaced IAS 39. And just looking at some of the key changes that IFRS 9 brought in on slide 5, the underlying principle for the classification of debt instruments is that we are looking at the information or choosing a measurement basis that will give useful information about how the future cash flows on the instrument will be realized. In other words, will it be coming from collecting the cash flows? What kind of cash flows is it on the instrument, and how the entity is managing those assets? And I think it's important to note at this point that the real changes in IFRS 9 came in for debt instruments, where we're using the business model and the contractual cash flow characteristics. For equity instruments, the default measurement in IFRS 9 is that it is measured at fair value through P&L, and that the presentation option to take the changes through OCI that Edgar has mentioned is really sort of an exception or a special case. So it's, you know, the intention was never for the board to, the board's intention was never for this category to be a widespread application issue. But, you know, default measurement for equity instruments is just basically fair value P&L. On the debt instrument side, what's important is how the entity is going to collect the cash flows, whether it's planning on collecting the contractual cash flows, does it measure what kind of risks the entity is monitoring with these assets. And so maybe if we move on to slide 6, we can see the interaction between the cash flow characteristics. So in other words, what are the features that are driving the amount, the timing, and the uncertainty of the cash flows coming from the instrument? What is causing variability in those cash flows? And if it is anything other than just collecting the principal and interest, then the instrument will be measured at fair value through P&L. But if it is, you know, simple cash flows that are consistent with a basic lending arrangement, then the instrument might be eligible for the amortized cost or fair value OCI measurement categories, depending on the business model. And just to maybe mention on this slide briefly that the fair value option is still available when an entity wants to avoid accounting mismatches in the measurement of, you know, assets and liabilities, for example. But the other reasons why the fair value option was available under IAS 39, so for example, the bifurcation of embedded derivatives or managing the assets on a fair value basis, because those two elements are no longer relevant, the fair value option is really only now available for when you're managing or you're trying to avoid or reduce an accounting mismatch. Because if you're measuring the asset on a fair value basis, then, you know, you will measure it under the mandatory fair value through P&L categories. And because we are no longer separating the embedded derivatives, we also don't need that reason for the fair value option anymore. Of course, this, you know, it still stays the same for financial liabilities, So we didn't really change the measurement and the classification of the financial liabilities. It's pretty much still the same as it was under IAS 39, apart from the own credit changes, which are presented in OCI. So if we maybe go on to the next one. Thanks, Anna. So the ECL model, the impairment model in IFRS 9 that replaced the model in IAS 39, is really based on the stages of deterioration in credit risk for a financial asset. So stage one is where our performing assets are. They are performing as we intended when we initiated the instrument. And for those, an entity would just recognize 12-month expected credit losses. Once there has been a significant increase in credit risk since initial recognition, the instrument will move to stage two, where we recognize expected credit losses. And the final category, which is stage three, are for those assets that are credit impaired. So in other words, they are non-performing. And it's quite similar to the population of assets for which we had provisions under IAS 39. So if we think about the comparison between the IFRS 9 model and the IAS 39 model, then, you know, IAS 39 would make up stage three and maybe a part of stage two in terms of the IBNR, the incurred but not reported portion, or the collective assessments that was done under IAS 39. And the rest of IFRS 9 would be the incremental bit. In other words, we are recognizing expected credit losses on assets that we didn't have credit losses or provisions for before. If we go on to the next one, I'm not going to go into much more of the technical detail for the ECL model, but I just wanted to point out, or, you know, just remind, highlight a couple of the important points on the ECL model. And the first is that it is a forward-looking model, and it is intended to be more responsive to changes in credit risks, but the model itself would only be as good as the way in which different entities are applying the model. So, you know, if implementation of the model is not great, then I think, unfortunately, the ECL model will suffer the consequences of that as well. But because this is a forward-looking model that is looking at expected credit losses instead of the incurred credit losses we had under IAS 39, entities would need to consider a much broader range of information when thinking about measurement of the expected credit losses, but also which stage the assets should be allocated in. And, you know, although there's more judgment required in the ECL model and it requires a lot broader information to be considered, I think it doesn't mean an entity has a blanket or blank canvas to provide as much as they want or as little as they want, because the information that these ECL is based on should still be reasonable and supportable. So there should be a basis to justify the information that has been used. We've only got one impairment model that applies to all the debt instruments that are subject to the ECL requirements. So in other words, those that are measured at amortized cost and fair value through OCI. So there's one model, and the same model applies in the same way to all instruments, and that has reduced quite a lot of the complexity we had with IAS 39 with different models applied at different stages. The other important thing just to highlight is the enhanced disclosure that was put into IFRS 7 to accompany this model, because the disclosure is really focusing on letting management tell the story of how they manage credit risk, what is the entity's exposure to credit risk, how things have changed during the period, and also where there are or there could be significant concentrations of credit risk, whether that be, you know, certain products, certain geographies, or certain risk categories or ratings. We can go on to slide 9, I think. I've already touched on many of these points, but I think, you know, the only one to maybe pause a little bit at is the first one, in just reminding ourselves why the board developed the expected credit loss model in IFRS 9, and that was really to address the, you know, the too little too late criticism that we had with IAS 39, where during the financial crisis the bank said, well, we couldn't book the losses at the end of 2008, although we knew the losses were coming. We couldn't book them because they haven't been incurred yet, although we expected those losses to happen. And so what IFRS 9 is telling entities is to take into consideration the expectations based on what you know at the balance sheet date. I think that's all I wanted to highlight on this slide, Anna. Maybe the last one on disclosure. And again, I think, you know, I've talked about the disclosure that went into IFRS 7 to support the ECL model. But what is important to realize and remember is that those disclosures are objective based. So we didn't list a lot of the required disclosures that entities has to make. We've listed what the disclosure objectives are. So in other words, what do entities need to get across to the users of the financial statements? And then we've provided some illustrations and, you know, list some examples of disclosures that would help entities achieve those objectives. But it is quite important to, you know, remember that whatever we disclose on the ECL model needs to achieve these objectives. In other words, telling the users the financial statements, how the entity managed the credit risk, give some quantitative and qualitative information about those amounts in the financial statements and what drives those amounts, and also where are the credit risk exposure in terms of concentrations, as I've mentioned earlier. And I think, Anna, that's all I have to say about IFRS 9 for now. I don't think we need to talk about hedge accounting for now, because we're not really focusing on that for now.
Thank you, Rihanna. I'm going to go through the research opportunities related to IFRS 9, and then we'll turn to our panel. So IFRS 9 brought many changes to the accounting for financial instruments, and therefore what would be useful to the board for the upcoming post-implementation review would be evidence from any studies that examine the impact of these changes. And it is important to say that it is useful to have evidence from studies that employ a wide range of methods. So helpful evidence would come from studies that look at the impact of the changes on companies, how their practices changed and what financial impacts they incurred, but also the impact of the changes on the market participants and the observed market outcomes. Now, just to dive deeper into some of the areas of the standard and the related research opportunities there, I will talk briefly about the expected credit loss model, the classification and measurement changes, also research opportunities related to the transition approaches and the new disclosure requirements. On the topic of the new expected credit loss model, it would be interesting to know what the impact on reported numbers and financial ratios is. And we've already seen some evidence from Edgar's paper that was presented earlier. Also, pertinent questions here would be how the calculations that entities perform of the expected credit losses reflect the underlying economic fundamentals of these companies, and whether the application of the model varies in the cross-section between companies, industries, and countries. And of course, it would be useful to have evidence on by studies addressing big questions such as whether the improved measurement of impairments contribute to goals such as financial stability. On related to the classification and measurement changes, and specifically to the removal of the available for sale category for equity instruments, it would be here helpful evidence would come from studies that examine what investments were affected by these changes and what is the significance of these investments for companies, what new policies are companies using, how prevalent is the OCI election, and also how investors respond to these choices that companies have made. Thirdly, research opportunities related to transition choices, and it would be helpful here to have evidence that by studies that examine separately the transition choices for the expected credit loss and the hedge accounting. So interesting and useful questions to address here would be, what are the transition approaches that companies have adopted, and whether these approaches vary by company and vary with certain company characteristics, and also what are the market impacts observable as a result of these companies' choices. And finally, on the new disclosure requirements that Rihanna talked about that were introduced in IFRS 7 for expected credit losses and hedge accounting. Here it would be useful to have evidence on whether the disclosure behavior of companies changed as a result of the standard of framing those disclosure requirements as more objective-based. Another pertinent question would be whether the new hedge accounting disclosures facilitate better understanding by users of the risk management and the impact of hedge accounting on financial statements. Also, useful evidence would be whether the better variation in the quality of disclosures that are related to expected credit losses and hedge accounting are associated with certain, explained by certain factors. For example, do regulatory effects play a role here? And also whether the disclosures that are observable have, whether it is possible to estimate and appreciate the costs and benefits of better disclosures. So I will stop here, and hopefully we can continue this discussion. We'll be waiting for the questions in the chat room.